Welcome back to Rude Dude.
Welcome to the Rude Dude Recovery Podcast with your host and resident wet brains, Cam and Hen, two dudes navigating the waves of wellness. Thanks for being here. This week, the dudes sit down with a very special guest, Dr. Kevin Blankenship. Dr. B is the founder of Jacob's Ladder, the six-month experiential treatment facility that saved Hen and many others' lives. We pick his brain about the method that's given them a 75% success rate, why he created Jacob's Ladder, and the hurdles that addicts and providers alike face in treating addiction. Please enjoy episode 81 of the Rude Dude Paul. The Rude Dude Podcast, the show that puts some pep in your step, takes some weight off your plate, and reminds you that haters are going to hate, but you are loved. We are your favorite recovering alcoholics, Cameron the Cree Davis, and myself, Henny Lokes the Lobster. How you doing there, Cam?
Well, you know, man, I'm doing pretty damn good today. I had one random curveball before we jump right into this interview. We now get like text messages from my daughter's teacher, and I had my first little student issue. A kid told my daughter that he was going to have his dad punch her in the face. And so we had to sit here and wonder what that was about, dude. So I guess I gotta punch dads in the face, dude. So massive issues going on over here with dads coming in punching kids in the face, dude. But I'm doing good, bro. I'm doing good.
Listen, if we're fighting dads, I'll be on the first thing smoking, bud. I'm on my way.
Dude, I've seen you in action before, bro. So I feel good about that. He kind of jumps in like Superman and just starts pounding away, dude. I feel good with you on my side.
All right, man. Well, I've also had a good day today, and I'm very excited about our guest. Without further ado, I guess let's get into it, right?
Yeah.
So this is a very special person to me. Almost would say my West Virginia parents or family at minimum. He is an MD, an entrepreneur, a proud and loving father, husband, and most recently, grandfather, and an extremely passionate advocate for recovery and mental well-being. Ladies and gentlemen, I present the one, the only, Dr. B.
Hey, Henry. Hey, Cam.
How's it going, Dr. B? First and foremost, man, thanks for coming on. And if you listened to the last episode, I am so sorry because I called you Dr. Bob. it was hilarious because he always calls you Dr. B, and we were talking about recovery. And of course, me being an AA, you know, recovery guy, I was like, man, I'm super excited to have Dr. Bob on. And Henry,
hey, that's a compliment.
I was wondering if that would come up, but yeah, this is West Virginia Dr. Bob.
I love it.
There we go, dude.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on. We're very, very excited to have you. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
All right. Well, I was born and raised for the most part here in West Virginia. Grew up down in the southern part of West Virginia. My dad was a coal miner. Joined the Army out of high school. Didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. You know, ultimately went back to school at West Virginia University. Got my pharmacy degree, got out and worked as a couple of years as a pharmacist, and then I went back to med school, same place, did my residency there in emergency medicine, and worked several years getting out of there in the ERs, and ultimately started working in urgent care. Did that for a few years, and my son's issues with addiction got me involved basically in recovery and addiction work, and that all began back in around 2010 or so. And that ultimately culminated in what is now Jacob's Ladder, a six-month treatment program that Henry knows very well, up in the wilds of Aurora, West Virginia, on a farm.
Two-time attendee. I liked it so much I came back.
Hey, you got to do it till you get it right, man.
Takes what it takes.
Yep.
Well, you kind of led into my next question, which is, can you tell us a little bit about the backstory with Jake and his issues and how that led to Jacob's Ladder?
Yeah, Jake's story is probably pretty typical of most young folks these days who are struggling with addiction. He started, you know, using in high school, drinking, smoking weed, you know, the typical teenage things, which I assumed he was going to experiment and grow out of and move on and grow up and do the things that we all do, normal people. You know, he ultimately started using heavier stuff. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but, you know, got into pills and smoking oxys. And by the time I found out he really had a problem, he was using heroin. He was IV injecting and really had a significant problem. You know, when I was faced with that as a physician, it's so sad because people out there, or I'm on the inside and didn't know what the hell to do. Mm-hmm. People on the outside have no idea what to do and have, you know, the resources are so limited and there's not any signs and you know, roadmaps and people guiding you through this process. So I reached out to friends and colleagues and tried to get him help back in the early 2010s. And Suboxone was just coming on the scene. And I got him in a clinic, I got him a therapist, I got him on Suboxone, thought we had things, you know, well in hand. He did that for about a year and then just went off the rails. And you know, I'm lucky to have him. Lucky that he's alive. Lucky that he's not in prison. He really got into some significant legal issues as well as his obvious addiction issues. He went away for a 6-month. You know, when I was facing his addiction, I'm like, you know, how am I going to save my son? You know, if everything I'm seeing out there, you know, when I talk to folks and they're like, yeah, 30-day programs are pretty much the standard. But, you know, to be honest, you know, you're seeing 10 or 15% success rate with those. Mm-hmm. And they measure success after about 6 months, maybe a year, if they're mm-hmm. really a good program. And I said, you know, I don't want to take that kind of risk with his life. What else is there? There's got to be something more long-term than that. You know, if a physician has a problem with substance use or a pilot or a lawyer, you know, your professional association has programs in place that will monitor you for 5 years. You'll be in a 5-year program. So we think it's that important, you know, for these professionals to have long-term treatment, but yet most Americans, you know, if you're lucky, you get a 30-day stay somewhere and a pat on the ass on the way out the door, and then you get scolded for relapsing and doing the whole thing over again. So anyway, long story short on Jake, I found a treatment program out west in Arizona. It's called Back to Basics, and it's a 6-month residential program. Experiential therapy, it looks a whole lot like Jacob's Ladder. And the reason for that is because I copied it after Back to Basics for the most part, because it worked for him. And I watched it work for him. He spent 6 months in their program, another 6 months in their aftercare program, their sober living setting, and then came back home to West Virginia and spent another year and a half in sober living there. And I'm happy to say he's 8 years into his recovery right now, is one of my full-time techs up at Jacob's Ladder, and is out there saving guys' lives every day. And I couldn't be more proud of him.
That's super awesome. Now, was that sort of your first encounter with, you know, addiction, aside from the people that you would see coming through your clinic, like from a loved one's perspective?
Well, I did have a niece that had an issue back late, like 2008 or so. And it was a brief moment in time. And I got her in some help and she's been fine ever since. But other than that, yeah, it was my first. Obviously in the ER, you know, I'm used to overdoses and all the things that we would see there. But, you know, it's a different world seeing it on that end than on the end I'm at now.
Absolutely.
So I would venture to say that, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of parents struggle with addicted children, but don't end up opening their own rehab. So how did we get to there? Like, how did we come from inception and into making it happen?
Yeah. I tell Jake all the time, you know, I'm supposed to be retired, man. Yeah. That was my plan. I was riding off into the sunset, planning to kind of take it easy and golf for a while. But yeah, his addiction basically kind of pulled me back into the game, number one. And number two, you know, it took my heart over. I mean, it just, once I started really getting involved in it and meeting these amazing people who were putting their lives back together and doing everything they could to live a healthy life. You know, every one of them reminds me of Jake, and I can't stop. I mean, I don't know how I ever get away from it, to be honest with you, at this point.
Yeah.
That's another thing that we've mentioned here on this show, and we've heard it from a lot of people who aren't, you know, addicted to substances. It's that special shine, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You can see it, and yeah. it's like, hey, I know the real person's in there, and it yeah. seems like you can see it too, right? And you're like, hey, let me show you the way. I think that's fantastic. I love when people have that insight, especially people who aren't like in the recovery community that just know like, hey, there's a better person in there. They just don't know how to get that person out of that shell.
I tell people all the time, man, I talk to folks on a pretty regular basis. You know, whoever wants help, I try to help. And I tell them all the time, these folks who are going through what they go through and the trauma that they experience, just the trauma of their addiction, let alone what trauma might have led up to their addiction, but the trauma of their addiction alone, losing everything, you know, being ostracized, being stigmatized, all these things that they've gone through, if they have suffered through all that and they clawed their way back and got themselves healthy and got themselves a job, and got their license back and got their marriage back and got their kids back, these are the most resilient, amazing human beings you could ever meet. And the rest of us pale in comparison. So I just... You know, I don't understand how people can look down on someone who has done so much work and suffered through so much and came out on the other side and not have anything but awe for that person.
We talk about that all the time. You know, everyone could benefit from recovery, a 12-step program. It's a living program, right? And we do Absolutely. This work, and most of the people, including the ones that probably especially the ones that look down on us, never do this kind of work or look at themselves or think twice about their actions or, you know, what might not be okay and so on and so forth. But I do tell everyone that will listen that the secret sauce of Jacob's Ladder is that it's, you know, owned and ran by you and your incredible wife, and you guys actually care. And that's the difference. It's not, I know, I don't think you make any money off it. I know it's a labor.
Quite the opposite.
For the audio listener, so he shook his head immediately.
Just a sad, slow shake, dude.
Yeah, and
that's
so,
my recovery. That's my retirement. We're talking about.
I know, and that's the difference. You know, there's these pill mills and places that are, you know, trying to get through on insurance money. And I know of several people personally that you've just granted scholarships to just because you care and you want to help people. So that's absolutely the secret sauce of Jacob's Ladder is at the bottom of it. You know, there's two really awesome people that care. So why don't you tell us a little bit about like the core value and principle behind Jacob's Ladder and the style of recovery you teach, what you set out to do.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Henry, and appreciate the kind words. You know, there's a lot of people involved in Jacob's Ladder, and certainly yeah. Stephanie and I do everything we can, but we've got a great team of folks up there,
yeah.
and every one of them to a person gives a shit.
Yeah.
Every one of them loves what they're doing and loves the people that they're helping. And that's, you're right. That is definitely part of what makes it work. The other things that make it work and things that I focused on when I put this together is number one is time.
Yeah.
And what people don't, what we didn't know 10 or 15 years ago, because brain imaging has become so much better over the last 15 years. And I mean, it's amazing the technology advancements just in 15 years in brain imaging. And we used to be under the impression that if you've damaged your brain, and I consider addiction, you know, a damaged brain.
Me too.
Same.
If you've done that, you know, we used to think, well, there's no coming back. You can't fix brain damage. I mean, you know, you can't repair a brain that has been damaged. But we know that's not true now. Now there's neuroplasticity, and people talk about rewiring the connections in the brain. All of these things are real. And so one thing that's absolutely crucial in that is time. And so for us to think that in 30 days, which is 95% of the programs in this country, 30-day programs, if you're lucky enough to get a program, in 30 days, you're going to come in and detox. You're going to meet your therapist. You're going to establish a rapport, and you're going to deal with all that underlying trauma that you're bringing with you in 30 days and heal from your addiction. And 6 months is not enough, but it's so much better than a 30-day turnaround. I mean, you can do so much more. And Henry knows this. It's really by about the third month before the light bulb kind of clicks on over their heads.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're so used to going through this routine of this revolving door of telling us what they think we want to hear, you know, playing the game, yes, sir, no, sir, you know, doing whatever my parents want, blah, 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 blah. And then about 2 or 3 months, it starts getting real, and they're like, shit, I'm really up here on this farm, and I'm still here, and I'm still alive, and all of a sudden, these things they're telling me are starting to make a little bit of sense, you know? And I don't think they're bullshitting me anymore. I think they truly do accept me unconditionally. I think they love me, you know? These guys come to our program, and they learn it's okay to hug another guy. It's okay to say, mm-hmm. I love you. It's okay to care about each other. Mm-hmm. And that's the other part that I think is a secret sauce up there. And that is we beat down these stereotypical ideas.
Tough guy.
Yeah. Because if you go out, it doesn't matter what program you go into. If you go back out with that same facade of being the tough guy that you had to be when you were using, and you know, this puffed out image that we all carry around. If you go back out there with that same facade, you're not being honest. And if you're not being honest, you can't be in recovery. It's plain and simple. That honesty is a basic function of successful recovery. And if you're not practicing honesty every day, you're on your way to relapse. There's no way around it, man. If you start being dishonest, you start manipulating, you start cheating here and just stretching a little bit there, you're going to be where Henry was, you know, 30 days ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's a slippery slope, and there's no getting around it. But the difference for Henry and for guys who come through our program is he knew what to do, and he knew who to listen to, and he knew, you know, I can't let this keep going. I got to change it right now. I'm not going to head down that path for 2 years and just waste everything that I've gained over the past few years. And so, you know, that's the other thing that really works for us up there. But anyhow, as far as the program goes, we have your normal therapeutic range of things, you know, cognitive behavior therapy. We incorporate trauma therapy. I don't know if we had that back when you came through or not, Henry.
The second time you guys were doing trauma therapy, yeah.
So we added trauma therapy, EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a big thing these days, especially for post-traumatic stress, lots of trauma events, that kind of thing. It helps you process and change the way that your mind remembers some of that trauma so that you can deal with it a little bit better. And we're seeing a lot of success with that right now. We have a big part of our program is mindfulness and meditation,
mm-hmm.
Because it's been proven time and time again that rewires your brain. It changes the way your brain works. We have the farming that's part of it. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, this is some kind of a work camp and, you know, we've got guys working on a farm all day long. And, you know, parents will call me up and they're like, I love what you're doing up there. Put those fuckers to work. Yeah, that's good. Put them out there in the field for 12 hours and that'll make a man out of them, you know. And I'm like, yeah. No.
It's like 8 hours a week, maybe.
That's not what we're doing, you know. Yeah. It's been maybe an hour a day or something like that over there. And it's, you know, it's dealing with the animals. It's doing simple things, but you're getting your hands dirty and you're getting back to the earth and you're getting outside of your head and you're starting to think differently about things. You start thinking about future. You know, you plant something, you're not going to get anything from that tomorrow, right? So you quit thinking immediate satisfaction kind of things and you start thinking long term, and that changes the way your brain starts working. And so now you're not thinking about that fix 4 hours from now. You're starting to think about something 3 months from now, and it changes the way that your brain works. And so, you know, you throw it all together, and it just, you know, we've been very fortunate. We measure our success at 2 years. So 2 years from the time they come to our program, whether they are out there healthy, taking care of themselves and their families, and we got about a 74% success rate.
And that's incredible. And I think you're, hats off to you, but I think you're really onto something with the time frame, right? Like the 6 months. I can relate to that. I wasn't able to get into a treatment facility, right? Like just insurance issues. But I went the AA route, and to be honest with you, I think it took around 6 months for me to get fully through the steps, right? And for me to fully kind of get it, right? Like to just kind of sit back and be like, okay, hey, this is my life. And I think there's a very important point in there, like you talked about with the neuroplasticity, right? Like changing these habits, changing these neural pathways take fucking time.
Yes.
That is not going to change in 30 days. Hell is not. It's not going to change in 60. And you know what I mean? Like it may take a full year, 2 years. I mean, I'm still trying to build new highways over here.
Yes.
and I'm working towards 7 years, you know? So it's just, I love the idea of it, and I can see why it's so successful. Congratulations on the 75%. That's incredible.
Yeah. We're pretty pleased with it ourselves, and it's, you know, it's a number, but it's guys, you know, and Henry knows this. Our alumni has grown. You know, we opened in 2016, so we've been open to 8 years, and we've got over 150 guys out there right now who are just knocking it over the fence. I mean, one of our guys just, you know, 2 months ago passed the bar. I mean, he went back to undergrad, got his undergrad, applied to law school, passed the bar. I mean, this is a guy who should be dead.
Is that Jake?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And, Shout out to Jake, Pawpaw.
Yeah, man.
Wow.
He's out there just doing it. And that's just one, you know.
Man, it's giving me chills.
These guys are out there taking care of their families. They're doing their jobs. They're doing what they have to do to stay healthy. They're going to meetings. They're helping other guys. That's probably the most important thing that's going on, because probably half of our guys end up working somewhere in the field of addiction and help other people. And so it's been very rewarding.
Yeah, that's giving me chills. I talk about that a lot, and you know, you alluded to it earlier, like these people that change their lives, like people want to give up on addicts. And I know there's another guy in the meetings, not from Jacob's Ladder. He's a doctor now, and Jake passed the bar. And most of my friends, like you said, from Jacob's Ladder, not are helping other people.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about, we don't get pulled out of the fire to walk away. We get pulled out to turn around, pull other people out. And the Jacob's Ladder alumni thing is so real. I'll meet a Jacob's Ladder alum that I've never met before and probably tell him I love him the first day I meet him. I call the sober house. Does anybody there need work? And I, you know, get some guys to get some cash in their pocket when they're fresh out and don't have any work, like whatever I can do for my brothers, you know. And you guys have really emphasized that. And it's really, everyone can feel it. All the new guys that come through, everyone can feel it and everyone knows it. But yeah, man, on the program, that 30 days, when you're recovering from 5, 10, 15 years of daily use, you're barely a human being again after 30 days.
Straight up.
And for my first month at Jacob's Ladder, if you remember, I was quite the miserable prick. I was the rehab connoisseur. All my rehabs had chefs. I was pissed off. I just cooked my own fucking food.
Sounds about right.
And But, you know, it was interesting, like, with the farm stuff. I had been to, you know, a lot of rehabs, they have, like, the insurance stuff, and they're like, this one kid brought a skateboard, but they wouldn't let him touch it because of insurance or whatever. I got to Jacob's Ladder on, like, day three. They put a chainsaw on my hand and put me in a tractor. I was like, let's fucking go. I could do this. This is all right, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that length of time, I remember, you know, part of when I first got out, we talk about like habits and neural pathways. When I had gotten out, I hadn't drank for 6 months. It just wasn't a thing I did anymore. It wasn't a habit of mine. It had been so long that it just, I didn't do it anymore, you know? So that length of time. And I love the farm because a lot of rehabs, you sit in the classroom all day and you take notes or you do workbooks or whatever. So this is like, you know, doing all that stuff on the underneath that we don't may not see at first, but it's also just like you said, getting outside, getting your hands dirty, working with animals. I helped pull a baby lamb out of a mother and all kinds of stuff. And I talked about, you know, I used to take bales of hay to the cows in the far pasture. It was snowing. There's like the white hills and the snow on the trees, and it's silent beside the rumble of the tractor. And it was like my moment of zen where I was by myself and I was cruising on a fucking farm in West Virginia. I couldn't have showed you where West Virginia was on a map before I came out here, and I did not want to go, to be clear. But I had this moment of zen, and I actually got to tell you an interesting story. So Recovery Boys documentary came out while I was in Jacob's Ladder, and we watched it. And they showed those snow-covered hills that I was speaking of in the documentary. And I was like, man, that's so fucking gorgeous. And I had a moment where I was like, dude, you're there. That's where you are. Like, if you can appreciate it in a movie, you're literally driving that same tractor on the same road of this thing you're in awe of that's on the TV. And that was like this huge moment of gratitude and appreciation and mindfulness, perhaps. Hey, why don't you, instead of being like, hey, that pretend place on the TV is cool, why don't you appreciate where you're at? Because you're there.
Yeah.
So that was a huge moment for me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. No, I forgot about the movie coming out when you were there. That had to be surreal.
It was. For you guys. Yeah.
I remember we got together and watched it.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
Yeah. That was the time when it was still very early in the program. And I also remember my favorite line was you coming in for a meeting going, guys, we're building this plane while we're flying it. Like, what the fuck? I wouldn't have bought tickets to a plane that wasn't built. What's going on?
Yeah. I used to tell you guys that all the time. I mean, it was true. I mean, I'm not a specialist in addiction medicine. And even if I were, I don't think I would know anything except, you know, the normal way of business out there. Yeah. And me as a parent, when I'm looking at that and I'm saying, wait a second, should I be okay with a 15% success rate? I mean, is that really, I mean, no one should be okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going into surgery and they were like, yeah, there's a 15% chance you'd live, you'd be like, well, I'm going to pass.
Right. And that's unfortunate in this country. I mean, we've treated mental health issues and addiction in particular. We've treated it basically as a non-issue that can't be fixed and that only self-help, you know, and 12-step, you know, has its place. In recovery, absolutely, and we use it. But for the longest time, that's all there was. And then the Betty Ford model came out, the clinic out in Minnesota, and it was a 30-day program. And then the insurance companies, being the way insurance companies are, decided, well, that's what we'll pay for then, a 30-day stay, and that's the way it's been ever since, even though everyone knows that's not going to work. But we play this game of saying, well, that's the way, that's all there is. You know, that's what the program is. You go do your 30 days, and there's all these expectations and these axioms that I like to rail against. And one of them is that relapse is part of recovery. And that's bullshit. I mean, relapse will kill you. I mean, relapse is part of being put in the ground, in my opinion. We shouldn't tolerate relapse. I mean, we should be fighting for most people never relapsing, most people healing their brains, most people getting the treatment that they need the first time. The other one is, you know, it takes 8 or 10 programs before you get it right. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Why is there a revolving door? Why would the insurance company pay for you to go somewhere 6 different times for 1 month rather than just a 1 6-month stay when you can get it right the first time and stay alive?
Is there any hope of ever changing that from the insurance side?
It's going to take legislation. It's going to take, I'm sure you can imagine what that would look like. You know, it's going to take legislators working with insurance companies and lobbyists to change that. And these things change so, so slowly. I don't anticipate it changing in my lifetime, unfortunately. But I wish it would. I wish more programs. You know, if insurance companies paid for 6-month programs, they'd be all over the place because everyone knows they work, you know. But if you can't monetize it, if you can't make money off of it, no one's going to open it. You know, I funded Jacob's Ladder for the first 3 or 4 years of its existence because we just didn't, you know, there were some families that could pay and most families couldn't, and insurance companies would pay you for 3 or 4 weeks. And so we just, you know, we've hobbled it together as best we can as we go along and try to raise money and fundraise and, you know, get grants when they're available and that kind of thing. But, you know, it's just, there's no money to be made to do it. So no one's going to do it. And that's what has to change.
Okay. I'm curious, with that high success rate, have you seen any up and coming treatment centers kind of take the Jacob's Ladder model?
Well, we've had a lot of interest in people calling, you know, and wanting to replicate what we do. And I think they all run into the exact same issue. And that is how do you stay afloat?
What a shame.
Once they understand that, you know, insurance companies won't pay for it and that, you know, there's not a lot of families out there that have the wherewithal to pay for it. You know, they just can't make it go. So it's a tough one. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, we've been fortunate in West Virginia, and I don't know if it's just because we've got such a good reputation with state Medicaid, but they've been really pretty good working with us and paying for these guys for most of their stay with us. Now, it's not, you know, great reimbursement, but it definitely helps pay the bills for us.
Yeah, something that you mentioned too that I wanted to touch on was you talked about how I, you know, struggled recently, but I knew what to do. And it made me think immediately, the way that we set up this interview was that I saw you at the Jacob's Ladder alumni breakfast.
And yeah,
that's exactly what to do. You call your sponsor, you go back to a meeting, you get back with your people. I've often opted out of the alumni breakfast because it's at 7 a.m. and I don't want to wake up any earlier than I have to. But I was like, this is what you need to do right now. You need to go see your people. And the warmth, the, you know, companionship, it felt like sitting, you know, a family reunion. We had you and Brandy and a bunch of the guys. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because that's exactly what happened. Like, I know what to do, and going to this alumni breakfast is part of it. And I talk about that all the time, man, just reaching out to your support group, talking to your people. You know, Randall Brown was one of the people I called when I was struggling, and he helped me, talked me through it. He checked on me. You know, I have the group and I have the people, you know, and it was, it was 3 Jacob's Ladder alumni who came and did, my little mini intervention. So you talk about brotherhood, you talk about guys, you know, taking time out of their day. All 3 of those guys were supposed to be at work, came in the morning and, hey bud, this ain't it. It's time to figure this out and get it right, you know. And man, it's just like, oh, it's heartwarming. And that's not the first time. You know, previously, after I had my 3.5 years, it was Ken, my buddy Ken, who I one time sponsored, and then one time he took me and dropped me off at a detox. But that's what we do for each other. You know, we pick each other up when we're down, and Cameron and I talk about that all the time, you know, who's in your corner and who's on your team. And another one Cameron likes to say is who waters. Some people come pick the fruit, but who waters the roots, you know? And my Jacob's Ladder family definitely waters my roots, man.
That's awesome. That's good to hear, man.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, to see the difference from Henry's experiences where, you know, we come from, what was it, Hen? Three treatment stays before Jacob's Ladder?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so three. We're going bouncing back and forth. But this model of just basically, it almost sounds like you've done exactly this, which is let's learn how to live again in a peaceful way, and let's talk about it and support each other.
And right? Make yourself like, dinner, you lazy fuck.
Yeah. And get yourself up, right? Like,
be a dude, big like, boy, make your bed.
You know, hey, it's time. It's almost like you're going back in a time machine, right? Like your parents are going to tell you to do chores, and you got to cook something. You're old enough to make a damn snack, right? Like my 5-year-old daughter can get a snack now. You can do it. You know where the garbage can is. But but it sounds like you do it in a model that's like still, you know, there with love and then effective therapy, right? Like that EDMR, I've heard of that in trauma therapy and stuff like that. I'm glad that that's having a high success rate.
Yeah.
That seems to be working.
Yeah, no, it's we've had a lot of success with it. You know, trauma is something that hopefully these days a lot of programs are starting to look into, but trauma is behind almost every person's addiction. And you know, people, you know, a lot of people will come and will say, well, no, I had a great childhood. I grew up in a loving house. You know, I no one beat me, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, tell me about when you were using, you know, did any of your friends die? Did you lose your house? Did you lose your job? Did you lose your kids? And you just start talking about the trauma of their addiction alone. And that's more than most people have ever suffered in their whole lifetime. You know, in the last couple of years, you just bundled all that trauma on top of it. So, you know, probably 70 to 80% of people who suffer from chronic addiction issues have some type of a trauma in their background. But 100% of people who we treat for addiction are suffering from trauma. And if you don't deal with that underlying trauma, when you have the opportunity to be with these folks, then it just keeps resurfacing. And it's, you know, like I told Henry and we were talking about earlier, we all carry our own shit around. The difference is you guys are actually dealing with your shit, and most of us aren't. But you know, the trauma of addiction alone, you know, burying your friends and starting to be okay with people dropping dead left and right, and, you know, doing things you never thought you would ever do, you know, selling your body to get money to use, you know, stealing from your parents. I mean, Jake stole from me. I mean, it's just heartbreaking for things like that to happen. And those are traumatic events, man. They're not small things.
They're super hard to deal with. Like, you know, even you just mentioning your son stealing from you, right? Like, there's still days where, you know, that stuff will pop up in my head and I'll think about it, right? Like, I remember I pawned like some of my mom's jewelry that like my dad bought her when they were like dating, and they were high school sweethearts. But I had to pawn that so I could go get some Paps, right? Like just this thief in the night. And it's just, it's so sad that's how we go. There's a great book on that, The Body Keeps Score, on trauma that I really liked.
Vanderkolk.
Yeah, it's a great book.
It's a wonderful book. And we recommend it to all of our families. We have a book list that we recommend. We have a family program as well. So we try to include the family, and we have a liaison, you know, one of the staff will be the liaison for that family and keep them updated. And we have a couple of family meetings during the time that the residents are up there. And I think it's really important for the family to try to recover with the person who's in recovery. I mean, it's, you know, you guys know addiction's not an individual path. It includes everybody around you. And it takes, you know, it takes a lot of healing from the family. I mean, my family has come through Jake's addiction so much stronger, so much more loving and in touch and caring for one another than we were before. And, you know, I sometimes call it the opportunity of addiction. Whenever something bad happens, and Henry knows this, if something bad happens up at the farm, for instance, I tell the guys, you know, this is not a negative thing. Nothing is positive or negative unless we make it so. You know, we label things as bad or good. Take whatever event happened and learn from it and bring something back from it, and it turns into a completely positive event instead of a negative event. You know, guys complain about sometimes up at the farm. They're like, we're just sitting around doing nothing today. I'm like, no, you're not sitting around doing nothing, man. You are learning how to be patient and be sober and not
sit with yourself.
And sit with yourself. Be okay with that.
Yeah.
If you're not, if you can't do that here with these guardrails around you, what are you going to do when you get out? If you've got to be entertained or be using or something to get away from your own thoughts on a regular basis, then, you know, you're not ready. You're not ready to get out there. You got to be okay with yourself.
Yeah. And I want to go back to trauma a little bit because it's so interesting. And I think it's different for everyone. And one thing I've heard talked about is like there's big T trauma and little T trauma. And I think one of the things people get caught up in is like the comparison. So this is my thing. I am the person who grew up like not really wanting for anything, like upper middle class, two parents that loved me and told me so on and so forth. And then when I hear about people who both parents died or they were in foster care or they lost their brother and then they lost their sister or all this stuff, I'm like, well, what I don't have any right to complain. Mine's not that bad. Nothing that bad happened to me. And I think we get caught up in that. It took me 2 years into being clean when I realized like the main source of what was bothering me and what I was constantly why I was constantly defending myself from people who weren't attacking me and so on and so forth. And I even about a year ago, I went and visited my cousin and she was like, yeah, Hen, your dad was really, really hard on you. And I started crying because I had it in my mind almost like I had made it up, you know, like it wasn't that bad. I don't have anything to complain about. But to hear somebody that I grew up with who was there for it, who saw it, validate it, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, that was really tough. I didn't just make that all up. So I think that's such an interesting topic because, you know, there's always someone in the rooms who has it worse than you, and there's always someone who will have it better than you, but it doesn't matter. Your bottom is your bottom. Your trauma is your trauma. Whatever brought you here is what brought you here. And there's no like comparison. And the comparison will also keep us out of the rooms. Well, I never did IV you. Well, I never did that. Well, I never shot up with puddle water. Well, I was never homeless. I'm not like these fucking people, da, da, da. You know, and that's why we talk about looking for the similarities because we didn't use the same drugs and I wasn't homeless, but I also lied to my, I also stole from my, I also, we, the stories are completely different, but exactly the same. You know, Cameron just did an awesome episode where he had his wife write down ways that he hurt her in his addiction. And I didn't do the exact same, I did some of the exact same things. And then there were some things that were crazy and random and wild. And I didn't do that thing, but I did a thing just like that because that's what we do when we're in addiction. But I guess the point for this little expose is, you know,
it had it all, dude. We had tears. We had cousins. We had it all going on.
I've been known to cry. Okay. I went to Jacob's Ladder. They taught me it's okay to be a soft ass dude. And
this is all Dr. Bob's fault.
You made me soft, Dr. Bob.
You gotta be okay with crying, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line, Henry, is that we're all just human beings, man. Yeah. We're all just people trying to get through life, and it doesn't matter, you know, trauma this, trauma that. I mean, it doesn't matter, except that you want to be healthy. And you know, big T, little T, it only matters what's inside of you. And you know, people use for a reason, and they use to escape pain. They use to, because they don't like themselves. And these can be for big reasons, or they could be for little reasons. But if I don't like myself, it doesn't matter if it's because my dad was an ass or just because I look in the mirror and don't like who I see. I still don't like myself, right? And so if you don't like yourself, I mean, that's the basis of so many people who are suffering from addiction, is that negative talk and that negative self-esteem and all the shame and guilt and all those things you pile on yourself and you can't forgive yourself for. And if you can't forgive yourself, you might as well be high, because at least it doesn't hurt, right? And so those are the things you've got to deal with. If you don't get through that, and you don't sit down with your family, and you don't lay it on the table and start speaking truth to one another and being honest with one another, even though you know it's going to hurt and you know you're going to boo-hoo, and every family visit we have is full of tears. And that's wonderful. I love it. Because if you're not doing that, if you're not working through that trauma and you're not working through that pain and that guilt and that shame, you're never going to come out on the other side an honest, healthy person. Yeah. And that's the only way you survive.
And that's a vicious cycle, too, because it's really hard to love yourself when you're lying, cheating, stealing, doing whatever you can. So you got to stop one to get the other.
That's why I always say, man, honesty is the number one prerequisite for a successful recovery. If you can't lay down in bed at night, put your head on the pillow and feel good about what you did today.
Proper behavior doesn't fear exposure, gentlemen.
There it is.
Shout out Randy Brown.
There it is. Sleep like a baby.
When he said, I don't lie because I don't do anything I have to lie about. Imagine that.
Epiphany time.
Never crossed my mind.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, man, like, you know, sitting there talking about like, hey, like dealing with all these emotions and having to pull yourself out, it brings me back to kind of something that you brought up way in the beginning of this episode, where you talk about how people in addiction who dig themselves out of these holes, right, and make their lives something. It was a Huberman Lab podcast where he actually, you know, he's a Stanford neuroscientist or something like that. He actually talked about this on an episode, that more study needs to go into people who have sustained sobriety, because they're almost like modern day prophets. The way that we are able to completely shift from complete chaos to a completely different person is almost unseen in the world. And that's going to lead me to my next question for you. What has, if anything, has rubbed off on you? Have you taken the time to work on yourself because you see a bunch of people doing it?
Absolutely. My life has changed completely. You know, I'm no different than anyone else. And, you know, I suffer from the same ego bullshit and facade bullshit and give me this and give me that we all suffered from for years. Jake's addiction, when it came and smacked me in the face, there was only one thing in my life that mattered in that moment, and that was my son's life. And it's been that way ever since, because now all I focus on is my family, the people that I love, the guys that come through the program. Those are the only things that matter to me anymore. I mean, I don't have any time for bullshit, facade, you know, lying, embellishing. You know, I am what I am. Henry knows if I'm going to be in a black T-shirt and blue jeans no matter where.
With
I
a little
go.
Flannel over top.
And it's because that's easy. It's easy. And you know, our family is so much better off now having gone through Jake's addiction than it ever was before, because we all openly share with one another. We are all honest with one another, and our the love of our family is just so much more than it ever was before. And interesting, I'll just tell you this little story about Jake. When Henry was talking about trauma, big trauma and little trauma, and remembering his dad, Jake grew up in a very loving home, a stable environment. These were all the things that I thought. And when he went away to this program, when we went in for the family program and they read some of his journal, with his permission, entries to us, and he was talking about growing up. And he said, I know my dad loved me, but he wasn't around much. And, I was going through med school and residency and working my ass off and building a business. And it never dawned on me that I wasn't there for my son, And that hurts today.
Yeah.
It hurts today. And knowing that that's what he needed and I wasn't there is what keeps me doing what I'm doing right now. Because I don't ever want to second guess my decisions ever again. I never, ever want to look back with regret. I don't want to think I could have done something different. I'm going to do everything I can every day to help as many people as I can. And that way, when I go to bed at night, I sleep just fine.
Oh, yeah. This is the good stuff. That's part of my story too. My dad was a workaholic, and so one of the things, and I try, we are our father's children, or I'm my father's son, but he thought providing financially was enough, and gifts and things like that, when all you want to do is like play catch in the backyard, right? So that is an interesting point. Another thing, we'll shift a little, and you actually kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the biggest hurdle you as a provider and us as addicts are facing with legislation around addiction? I know the insurance is one thing that we talked about, but
I think rather than, legislation is the ultimate end of it, but I think before legislation is the stigmatization. Because we're in this world now where if you're not us, you're them. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be in a camp, and you've got to have your tribe, and you've got to have your colors, and you're red or you're blue. And we are so fucking poised against one another right now. And people are so quick to throw people who are suffering from addiction into this barrel of those people. Until, of course, it's one of their own.
Yeah.
And then they call me up, and I have this phone call over and over and over with parents. They'll call me up and say, yeah, my son started hanging out with the wrong people. And I always stop him right then, and I say, sir, listen, if we're going to continue this conversation, you're going to have to understand something. Your son
is the wrong people.
Is the wrong people.
Bang, dude.
And then let me take it one step further and let you know that there are no wrong people.
Yeah.
We're all the same thing. And your kid was doing something that I did when I was a kid, and you probably did when you were as a kid. And he just wasn't lucky enough to make it through to the other side. Now he's suffering from addiction. He's got these legal charges. He's got this, he's got that, but he's alive, and let's get him better. And let's quit with this whole labeling of bad kids and good kids and addicts and this and that and the other. The stigma that we have to battle. When I go out and talk to folks, I'll go speak at different events and stuff and try to get people to talk about the issues of addiction, even in their own family. People are angry. I mean, they're resentful. They look at their child as doing something to them. You're doing this to me. You're hurting us with your addiction. You're selfish. You're hurting our family. You're making us look bad. Everybody talks about us. I have to bail you out constantly. Blah, 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 blah. And all that negative energy just rolls and rolls and rolls through the community. And Henry, you know what's going on in Morgantown, for instance, with just harm reduction stuff and needle exchanges and homelessness and trying to help folks. You get on social media, they are so angry. People, citizens of Morgantown are so riled up and so angry at them being the addicts and the homeless and the people and the advocates, the people who are trying to help them. Of course, you know, in their opinion, you're only helping them use because you're giving them clean needles. You can't make them understand what harm reduction is or why you're giving them clean needles and how that's not contributing to their addiction and how that actually opens the door for them to get into recovery. It's so hard. You just beat your head against that wall over and over and over because of the stigma. And so if we don't get past that part, where we can speak to a community and make them understand that we're talking about human beings here, and we're talking about your son and my son and our daughters and our moms and our dads, you know, we're never going to get to the point where we start talking about, well, how can we get legislation passed? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've got to come together as a community first and start supporting one another.
Yeah, one of the worst things is my friends, our people, set up booths sometimes and hand out Narcan, and they'll get people honking and "fuck you, pieces of shit," blah 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 blah. And it's you hit it on the head. It's the us and them thing. You know, one of the things I see a lot is the "why is Narcan free to an addict, but my insulin 700." Well, the question is simply, why is insulin $750? It's, you know, we wish that was free for them too. You know, it's not, but, and people with this, "we should let them die" attitude is just crazy. And I went on a mini rant on here about needle exchange before. And it's like, listen, a drug addict's going to do drugs no matter what. They're either going to do them with a dirty needle or a clean needle. And if they do them with a dirty needle, they're going to spread disease. And then you still have to pay for it. And probably it costs even more. Like, people hate the idea of fixing the problem upstream, you know, and it's so frustrating.
Yeah.
I think you're onto something there. It's like that preemptive strike, right? And I forget what podcast I was listening to, but it was like Peter Attia was talking about something like this. Like, even with just standard medicine, right? Where it's just, hey, how do we get it in the beginning so that it doesn't turn into a problem? Because it seems like the issue is where we're in this kind of like Band-Aid section of medicine where, oh, hey, this is ailing you. Here's some pills. Here's that. Pat on the ass. See you later. Instead, what we could be doing is kind of what you're talking about, like, hey, this is an issue right now, but here, this will help you get to the next step, and this will help you get to the next step, and this will help you get to the next step. You know, people can't see that far ahead. And you pointing that out, Henry, like, hey, okay, so here's what's going to actually happen if we don't have these clean needle exchanges. They're going to use that. They're going to get Hep C. They're going to come in. They're on state Medicaid, right?
Yeah.
And you're still going to pay for it regardless of your frustration. And then, you know, what's going to happen is then they're going to go share that needle, and then another person's going to get Hep C or HIV, and we're going to continue this cycle. So how do we fix this? And then, like Cassidy said on here, and I'm sorry, now I'm on my one show rant. What Cassidy said on here is this actually opens the door for a conversation like, hey, how are you doing today? You know, there is an option here for other places, a conversation that probably wouldn't happen in a back alley with a dirty needle, right? And so you're planting those seeds. But if everybody wants to get all up in arms about it, then guess what? Those seeds don't get planted, and then you're still going to have this problem, and it's just going to keep self-perpetuating and keep getting worse. It's really sad because people can judge so quick, and I've been guilty of it. You, as you're aware, probably aware of, California has a terrible homeless and drug crisis out here. It's out of control. I can sometimes still, even being in recovery, look at some of these people and just get fucking angry. Right. Like, come on, let's snap out of it. Right. Let's snap out of it. You can do this. And then I sit here and I go, wait, dude, like, if my family didn't literally let me live in their house, I would be one of these people. Like, can we take a deep breath, please? Mm-hmm. And it's not that easy, Cameron. Remember, everybody has a story. I don't know how that guy got there. I don't know how he got there, but I was one. No, Cameron, you can't stay here from getting there. So let's take a deep breath. I pray for him, and then I try and try to help the best I can. But you get what I'm saying. Like, I think it's just human nature for us, and the polarization. You hit something really high in there. I think it's just this: hey, you don't agree with me, I don't agree with you. Fuck you! Of attitude that needs to go away.
Yeah. No, it's pervasive, and it's screwing everything up in our country. There's no doubt about it. And it's so, you know, judgment is easy. I mean, it costs nothing. I mean, it takes no investment whatsoever. Yeah, you have to actually work to care. You know, it takes effort. But to pass judgment on somebody is cheap, and it's quick, and it's easy, and it feels good sometimes. You know?
It does, doesn't it?
That's the reason why human beings do it so well. And, it's just like addiction. I mean, our brains work the way they work for a reason. And the way we're able to process judgment is part of our survival instinct of telling whether something is
harmful. Right.
Yeah. Is this a danger to me? And so we can make that assessment pretty quickly. And it's the same way, you know, when you use, our brains are geared to, you know, make certain things attractive to us. Unfortunately, the brain didn't prepare itself for fentanyl and opiates and meth and things like that, which just push it 100 times past where it should be from a dopamine standpoint. So, you know, it's a normal brain activity to wire that way. It's just hijacked and multiplied by 100. And that's what addiction is.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing about recovery too is we all become kind of armchair psychologists. So the interesting thing about people who are passing harsh judgment is they're probably not very happy with themselves.
Oh, they're miserable.
You can flip it around and say, "Damn, bud, I'm sorry that you're so upset and you hate yourself so much that you have to like project this hate onto everyone else," you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, think about that negative self-talk that you had in your head back when you were using. That's where they're at every day of their life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they're just so unhappy and they're so miserable, and they project that out onto these unfortunate folks. And it's just, you're right. I mean, these are miserable human beings. And most people in society are miserable.
You heard it here first, straight from Dr. Bob. Hating on addicts is little dick energy. The littlest dick energy you could have.
Reporting live, dude. Straight to what do you got out there? The West Virginia, I don't know, paper. What's it called? The West Virginia Mountaineer paper.
We're in Germany. The
Dominion Post.
We're in Canada. We're all over the place. So
yeah, worldwide.
Let it be known. Little dick energy.
The smallest.
Love it.
Well, Ken, do you have another question for him, or should we get him out of here with our two standard ones? Because I think we've taken up enough of his time.
I have one last thing real quick. Okay. I've heard from a lot of people in the medical field. A lot of my friends work there. And you, of course, that the medical field doesn't really understand addiction. How do you think that physicians and the medical field mishandle or mislabel addiction, and you know, what's the solution there?
I think you hit on it there with your first sentence. We don't understand addiction, and I think that is a capital W. The world, and science and physicians in general, specifically rather, don't understand addiction. We're learning. And we're getting better at it, and we've made great strides the last 5 or 10 years, because we had to. Because this, you know, what happened with OxyContin and heroin and now fentanyl has just ramped up the game. 100,000 people plus a year die from an overdose. I mean, it's the number one killer for young people in this country. And so we've had to figure out and learn more about it. Now, having said that, are they teaching it in med school? Or are people coming out as physicians learning about it? I doubt it at this point yet. But hopefully we're getting closer
to where we all understand it a little bit better and we start dealing with it the way that it's supposed to be dealt with time and compassion and treating it as the disease process that it is. I think of it more as a brain disorder than disease. I don't care what you label it. I like the idea of it being a disorder because I think that's something that can be fixed. It's something that can be reordered. Mm-hmm. And I like for people to understand that I think you can recover ultimately from your addiction. I think you can be healthy and you can not use and you can live a normal, happy, healthy life out there for years and years and years to come if you just put in the work.
I will say one thing that happens around here, because we are right in basically on campus at WVU, is you'll see students come into the meetings to observe sometime. And it happened at my meeting last night, and you can tell because they're young, they have nice skin, they have no bags under their eyes, they're clean cut, and they're just, you could tell. And the beautiful thing, though, was they were in there, and we went to do the circle at the end, as we always do. We hug and we pray for those that don't know. And the circle was open. We were here, and they were over there, and they were kind of like, what do we do? And I was like, are you guys coming? And they were like, are we allowed? And I was like, of course, you know. And they came in, and they prayed with us, and then they thanked us. They were like, thank you, guys. That's so cool. And it's great to see them there to, like, that you know, like you said, someone's trying to learn about it. A and B, to show them what we do. Hey, everyone's welcome here. You know, we love unconditionally. Hell yeah, you're coming in this circle because this is family. You know, this is what we do
here. I love it. I love it, Henry. And by the way, guys, Cam and Henry, both, you guys, congratulations on your podcast. Congratulations on your recovery. I love watching what you guys are doing. I listen to as many of your podcasts as I can. Since the beginning, and I really, really enjoy watching you guys grow and watching this thing grow. So it's been fun.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that a lot, and the fact that you can even stomach listening to us two wet brains talk about anything maybe you got to go do a brain scan or something, Dr. Bob, because listening to us is quite wild. I will call you Dr. Blankenship moving forward. Sorry, the Bob joke was just too funny last week, and I can't let it go. Let's tie this up with a nice little quick bow. What would you tell somebody who's struggling right now, Dr. Bob?
Well,
I'll say it moving forward. Immediately says it 3 seconds later.
I think
we have fun.
The
here.
Most important thing that I would tell someone is that there's hope. You know, you can get better and you can get through this. All you have to do is ask for help and find the right people. You know, find the people who love you, get the people in your corner and tell and start being honest. Be as honest as you can be. But you can get through this. I mean, there's no way that you can't get through this. And a lot of times the people I talk to are parents. You know, who are reaching out. You know, it's not the person themselves. It's usually parents, and I usually give them the same advice because they're always, you know, do I lock them out of the house? Do I let them live in my house? Should I be giving them money? Should I not be giving them money? All these things that parents go through, and I always tell them, listen, it doesn't matter what you do. If their addiction is going to kill them, their addiction is going to kill them. It's not anything you do that is going to save them or kill them, except if you stop loving them. You have got to be their parent and help love them and support them and keep them alive long enough until you can get someone who can help them recover. You know, you can't make they're scared to death to make a wrong decision. And I say, there's no right way. There's no wrong way. You can let them live in your basement. You can make them live on the street. It doesn't matter. If they're going to die from their addiction, they could easily die in their bedroom, tonight if you're letting them live there. So, you know, are you going to blame yourself for that? You know what I mean? It's not your fault if they don't survive this. Love them as hard as you can love them. I remember the first meeting I went to out at Jake's program And, you know, it was a parents group and they were all talking about tough love. And, you know, I kicked him out and I haven't seen him in 6 months. And you know, that's going to change him. And I stood up and said, you know, listen, and maybe this works for you guys. And I hope it does. I said, but I love my son so much. And if his addiction leads to him dying in a ditch somewhere, I'm going to be beside him in that ditch, trying to help him. I'm not ever going to abandon my kid. And that's what I tell parents all the time. Love them as hard as you can love them and do your best and know that even then you may lose them to this, but that's not your fault. Do everything you can do to get them in somewhere and get them some treatment, get them some help. And hopefully you get with a bunch of people who will care about them and who will love them and who will take the time to help their brains heal so that they can be what they're supposed to be.
And now you got about 150 kids who you're laying beside in ditches and are laying beside each other in ditches, loving them to death. That's fucking beautiful. All right. And the very last question is, what's your favorite part about recovery?
Oh man, that's easy. It's just the pride of watching guys live their best life and be such wonderful human beings and being such great examples to the new folks who are coming into recovery. When I see, you know, you, Henry, and I see Teets and I see Ken and all these guys out there doing all the things that they're doing and being such a good example for the new guys who are coming out, they look at them and it's like they're looking at Superman, man. They're like, you guys are gods, and I want what you got, and I want to, you know, just lead me, show me how to do it. And they do, and they give so unselfishly of themselves. All you guys do. And that's, you know, for me to sit back and watch that happen. And like you said, Henry, you know, Father's Day comes around and I'll get, you know, 80 texts from these guys. Hey, Dr. B, happy Father's Day. This is the best thing in the world for me because, you know, I see Jake and every one of you guys.
Love it. Well, this has been fantastic, Dr. Blankenship. Thank you so much for coming on and being just an open book and being transparent. It's been really nice meeting you, and I appreciate you. I've watched the sun just slowly set beside you, and it's getting darker and darker out there. So we'll get you the hell out of here. But thank you again, and maybe this won't be the last time. Maybe we'll have you back on.
So I'd love to come back sometime, guys.
All right. I'm going to try to do this without crying. You know, I can't thank you enough for what you've done for me and what you've done for countless other men that I know. I know my family shares the exact same sentiment. They love you and they've maybe met you one or two times. I just think I can't express how amazing it is what you guys do and the love that you give to so many people. I was just talking about how we used to do Thanksgiving in your house and now we do it in a warehouse and it's like 300 people, you know, and it's just, and the fact that you're going to the alumni breakfast and checking on your people. I just can't express to you how much you and Stephanie and everyone at Jacob's Ladder means to me. And, thank you for doing what you do and saving my life.
We love you, Henry.
I love you too, man.
I love you too.
John. Love you too.
That's right. I got to get out there, brother. I got to get out there and shake your hand before you retire.
You better.
Speaking of that, when's that coming, real quick, before I kick you out?
Probably.
I'm never retiring. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I'm stuck. You're too important out
there.
Too
many people to save, baby.
All right. Well, hey, have a great rest of your evening. Thanks again, Dr.
All right, guys. Thanks. Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
Keep it up. All right.
Later.
Later, Dr. B. That's Damn, my guy. Dude. That's my fucking guy. Did I tell you or what?
Man, oh man, oh man. I can see why you guys in particular talk about him. Like the combo of having that guy as the doctor for the treatment facility and then like when you were there having Randall as a counselor, like there's no way you could fail, right? There's no way you could fail because you have people that are just so passionate, so in tune, right? And it comes through experience, which I think is absolutely beautiful, right? Like he saw it firsthand with his son, and then like all of a sudden it smacked him right in the face. And it's like, fuck, I got to figure this out. How do I figure this out? And then we go through these different types of models and different avenues. And then he finds the 6-month treatment and he sees that it's successful. And instead of just being happy with, hey, look, my son seems to be doing well. Fantastic. I'm going to go back to doing whatever the hell I was doing. Yeah. He goes, no, you know what? I'm going to do something about this. And what is fucking cooler than that, dude? I mean, what is fucking cooler than that? Had 99.9% of the human beings walking this earth would never do what he is doing. He has saved your life, dude. Like literally, I'm sitting here having a conversation with you, watching you cry, and my heart's melting because, bro, without him and the program that he created, I don't know if you're here today.
No, we don't have this. This doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And another thing that I know is a factor for him creating the rehab that he didn't mention is we are in the opioid epicenter of the world here, and there were like no treatments available here. So that I know, because he's talked about it before, that was another factor of like, how are we in the most heavily opioid, like, I don't know what I'm trying to say. You get it.
We get it.
impacted area of the world. Oh, yeah. And there's like, what, 3 freaking rehabs in the whole state or whatever it was. And he's just like, no, this is bullshit. And, you know, it was really cool. Obviously, I knew he loved his son. But, man, how cool is it to see that? You could see how fucking passionate he was. And that's the passion that they bring to everyone, man. And if you or someone you know is struggling, this is a men's program. They're working on opening a women's program. But if you want some more information, I will definitely put the links in the description. And there's also, if you're interested in donating, because they don't make any fucking money, it costs him money to run it, does it out of the goodness of his heart, that'll be in the description, because they do take donations. And I cannot tell you, I mean, you guys know, you heard it, but I cannot tell you how incredible that place and particularly the people who run it are, and how many people it's saved, and the family and the brotherhood that it's created.
Yeah, man. And Reddy, the numbers don't lie. 75% success rate is insane, man. That's insane. And that means they're doing something right, man. And it really just another thing that I wanted to highlight before we get out of here. One thing I really loved about him, and it just shone through, was his overall just love for people, right? Like he just has this like understanding of just like, hey, these are human beings who are sick, and we're going to get them better. Right. We're going to get them better. And that may be inherently in him because he's a medical doctor, but he just swerved and he took the batch of undesirables, which are people like you and I, and said, hey, I see you for what you are. I see you for what you are. Let's get you out of this. And it can make me cry, dude, because it's such a dark fucking place, bro. It's such a dark fucking place. It's so miserable. It's so terrible, as we all know. And to have somebody like that and an option and a place for someone to go to do that is just so fucking beautiful, dude. And man, it warms my little Caribbean heart, dude. And now I feel like a super asshole for calling him Dr. Bob like 12 fucking times.
Immediately after you said you would stop.
No, yeah, I couldn't help it.
But I'm not gonna let you get away with the maybe it's because he's a medical doctor, because I'm positive there are plenty of doctors that are highly judgmental of addicts, and or at least medical professionals. We also know a medical professional, if you would call him that, that is very judgmental of addicts, and they get jaded because, you know, they have bad experiences. But I'm not going to take this paintbrush and say all doctors care about addicts. There's no chance. There's no chance. So there's something special in him. And if you met his wife, you think Dr. B is cool. Stephanie is an absolute peach. I would travel to the ends of the earth for her. And I was thinking about it. We're going to have her on now because she is also incredible.
Yeah, dude. Good old, we'll have Sally Blankenship on, dude. Dr. Bob and Sally Blankenship, dude. I'm just playing.
Protect my people, dude. Dude, I will fight.
You guys can't get me, dude. I'll fight you in California.
And then I'll
never
fight that kid who threatened your daughters for you.
Oh, dude, we got to get over here.
And then I'll beat him up.
We got to get over here and beat some dad's asses, dude.
Anybody's going to be beating my homeboy's ass, it's going to be me.
All right. Well, yeah, man, we could sit here and break that episode down for 5,000 hours.
If you thought that was cool, we got another JL exclusive next week. So I'm just going to leave you on the cliffhanger, but we got another absolute banger of a guest next week that is going to drop some more knowledge. And if you thought your mind was blown, prepare to be blown again. Blown and blown and blown until you blow.
No way anybody is listening to this show again, dude. This is that's it.
Yeah,
Yeah, dude. Fantastic. So I will hit him with the spiel, dude. Follow us on Instagram. I'm very active on there now. I'm posting reels. I'm posting little motivational quotes.
Cam is Soshmead.
Yeah, Soshmead Cree, dude. We're over there. I'm posting Lorax memes. We're doing it all, dude. So get over there and follow us if you haven't. Also, there is a support this podcast button down here at the bottom of your Spotify page. If you feel like giving us a small monthly donation to cover our costs for StreamYard and, you know, Opus Clip and all the other fun things that help keep this podcast run, we would greatly appreciate it. Like Henry already
mentioned. And we're way broker than Dr. Bob, so you could donate to us instead of Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah. Jacob's Ladder's donation list will be at the bottom underneath the subscribe to this podcast button. Don't get it twisted. I want some Jacob's Ladder merch. They got like hats.
They
and
got
shit.
It. Yeah.
I'm gonna buy a hat and wear it.
Yeah. That would also support them. You can get you some merch.
Yeah. I have a Lauren's Wish merch, so I gotta get some Jacob's Ladder merch. I almost feel like I'm a part of the West Virginia community, dude.
I talk
to your friends, dude. I should be there.
Isn't that cool? You should. Isn't that cool? Yeah. We got a group chat with like Brandon or Austin and I was thinking about it the other day and I was like, how cool. He's never met these people. Like Austin hasn't even came on the show and you guys are just pals, palling around doing pal stuff.
Yeah, he was talking to me about fucking being a sommelier the other day, dude. Random conversations that you weren't even involved with.
Yeah.
Like be like, oh, dude, this guy's my friend. Yeah. Anyways, we digress. This is our alcoholism. See, we can't keep our fucking focus.
Whatever,
also, we're going to be setting up a Patreon for our Apple, Samsung, and Amazon listeners. So if you would like to support the podcast with a monetary donation, we would greatly appreciate it. That goes for you, Canadian, and Lloydminster. Throw us some Canadian schmeckles. That's all I have.
Dude, one more time. If you live in a foreign country and you're hearing my fucking voice, message us. Say what's up. Say
please.
Say hockey, eh? Or say, oh, this here I go being like racist.
This
or
is why, dude. This is why they don't talk to us, dude.
If you're in Germany, if you're in Canada, we see you. If you're in Singapore, we see you. We know you're listening. You're not getting past us, you little sneaky guys. Hit us up, dude. Say what's
Say
up.
Say hi.
We're cool dudes. Say hi. You hear us. We're nice. We're friends. We want to be your friend. My dad mentioned to me, he was like, because I told him all the countries, he was like, do any of those people, have they ever talked to you? I'm like, no, they fucking haven't. And we ask them all the time, and they never fucking do.
Dude, the California
Say
came
what's
out.
Good.
No, bro, they don't holler at us, dude. All right, dude. I got to go out of here and eat some pizza. Anything else you got to say?
Just that you will end it how you always end it, my brother.
That's right. Here we go. I will end it like I always do. I love you, Hen, very much. I love you, Dr. Blankenship. You are a radical dude, man, and there's a special place in heaven for you, my man.
That's right. I love you too, Cree. And remember, be like Dr. B and love everybody and be yourself and fuck what they think.
Everyone be like Dr. B, baby.
One of them see with the music and me regal. One of the puppies then boy.